real pleasure, though, to welcome to the studio our guest now, Dr. Tom Lindley. He's always been fascinated with fish living in the deepest parts of the ocean, how they behave, their ecology, and their different ocean habitats. He was part of the first team to capture video of the world's deepest fishes, including those living in the Kermadec Trench, with his work featuring in various shows, including Blue Planet 2 and Shark Week. He is, and this is a job title, curator of fishes.
Oh, we can go into that if you want to.
Curator of fishes at Te Papa, the National Museum, and also co-hosts the Deep Sea podcast, where he speaks with fellow scientists about their discoveries in the hopes of demystifying them. And he's also passionate about encouraging more neurodivergent people into science in this in the sector, welcoming them. Dr. Tom Lindley, good morning. Great to have you with us.
Morena, hi.
That Kermadec Trench has another part of the story. That's kind of how you ended up here, correct?
It is, it is. So we were specialising in the deepest places on Earth. So they tend to be the subduction trenches. So where the two plates push together, they buckle down, and that's where you've got the deep sea, but then that's the extra deep sea. That's deluxe deep sea. So that is the Hadal zone, beyond 6,000 metres deep. And our very own trench here goes to over 10,000 metres deep. It's the fifth deepest place on Earth. So I was a young, naive PhD student out here, and I fell in love with the ecology and the life in that trench, and I fell in love with New Zealand, and I fell in love with the team I was working with at Te Papa. And yeah, that was a real high point in my life. Carried on, wrote up my PhD, thought, oh, that was the perfect place and that was the perfect job. And then reality sort of called my bluff, and an opportunity came up, and I had to, yeah, pull up all my roots, pull up my family, but absolutely loving it here.
Very good.
Really enjoying it.
Now, I know this is naughty and not what you do, but to help my mind, 10,000 metres, we're talking 10 kilometres deep.
Yes.
Like if I'm driving along the road for 10 kilometres, that's really deep. How much of the world's ocean gets to be that deep?
Those deep cracks are actually really sparse. So it's about 1% of the Earth's surface. But if we're talking about the deep sea in general, that is over 54% of the planet's surface. The average depth of the ocean is about 4,200 metres. So we have a real bias towards the lovely sunny bits that we can see. But actually, this isn't just a blue planet, it's a deep sea planet.
Part of me, I'll get it out of the way now, just wishes we'd leave it that way. But there you go. We're humans and we just can't help ourselves. From your perspective, learning more about it has been a motivator and a huge part of our lives. What does it look like at depth? In fact, does it look like anything? What do you see? What do you experience when you go to those, to any depth of that level?
There's loads of different habitats down there, but in general, you end up with a very fine, silty material. So quite often the bottom is kind of soupy, fine, sandy sediment. And sometimes you see animals almost jumping like dolphins in and out of that sandiness. But there's rocky outcrops as well, and you end up with a little halo of sort of life around that. You end up with the filter feeder, so you have sponges and sea anemones and things like that, things that like a hard substance to attach to. And then you get some unusual sort of ephemeral habitats. You get things like the seeps, so like we know the black smokers. So sea vents where you get a whole dedicated community, and then you get things like whale falls. When big things die, they tend to find their way down to the deep sea, and there's loads of crazy specialised animals that just eat really, really specific things.
So they'll follow the whale to the bottom of the ocean, and
they've got a great sense of smell. So smell
just
is important.
Feed until they explode, do they?
Pretty much, and you'll have like generations going on there. So if you're a deep sea fish that doesn't get a chance to eat very often, it's a chance to pile on some calories. And to be honest, I think it's a good way of finding love. I think a lot of love is found in the deep sea over a date over a dead whale.
Wherever there is food, there is love.
Exactly.
Can you see anything though, like the human eye? Is it just pure black or what?
To most of our eyes, it would be sort of seemingly pure black, even though it's long, long beyond any light coming down from the sun. The animals down there make their own light, and this is bioluminescence, which is something that seems a bit alien to us, but it is probably the most common type of communication on the planet. Again, it's that weird bias where we think the deep sea is weird and it's not most of our planet. But yeah, that's the most common form of life. So you'd probably see these interesting sort of blue flashes of light. And that, when you can control the light as well as what you look like, there's a lot of deception in the deep sea. There's a lot of big things pretending to be small, like the anglerfish lure, and there's a lot of big things that are small things that are pretending to be big. So it's a really weird bit of ecology there, because if something is attacking you, actually your best defense is to make loads of light and try and attract the predator of that thing that's attacking you. So there's always a bigger fish.
He's over here.
Yeah, there's always a bigger
fish.
There's
a lot of human behaviour down there, isn't there?
It's deflecting the trick. Yeah, it's fascinating. And then there's tricky ones, because everything can see the blue light, but there's some tricky ones that use red light and nothing else can see it. So they've got night vision, essentially, which sounds crazy in the deep sea. So there's the stoplight loose jaw, which is a type of dragonfish, and it has a red spotlight and it can see just fine and nothing else can see it. So there's some sneakiness going on down there.
How deep have you been, presumably in a suitable vehicle?
Most of my stuff is remote. So I've sent some things that I've built down to over 10,000. But
right.
I was part of the Five Deeps expedition,
right,
which is when Victor Vescovo wanted to go to the deepest point in all five oceans. So that was a crazy ride. I was on the part of the science team during those, but I haven't got to go down myself.
Oh, so you haven't done the old autonomous vehicle thing. So what are you sending down to 10,000 metres? Is it, what kind of kit are you using?
The team that sort of trained me up and I came out of, we really like landers. So we sometimes call them pop-up vehicles. So basically, lowering something on a cable down 10,000 metres, the physics goes crazy. There's probably only a couple of ships on the planet that can do that.
Push back up again, is it?
Well,
what is the physics?
The weight of the cable gets heavier than the thing you're lowering, and so it overtakes.
Oh, and so the cable gets ahead of the thing.
Yeah, and then it all crashes. And the boat can't move. You know, you can't get out of the way with 10,000 metres hanging below you. It would probably take 10 hours to lower that down. So what we do is we drop it, which is frightening, especially when it's all my science.
Just free-fall it.
Yep, mm-hmm. Just free-fall it. Drop them from the surface. They fall down to sight. They'll do something we've programmed them to do, little pre-programmed task. It might be taking pictures. It might be taking samples. And then we'll send a burst of sound through the water column, which sounds like an old modem. And that gets it to drop a ballast weight, and then floats bring the whole thing back up to the top. And they don't teach you this in science school, but I'm pretty good at throwing a grappling hook, because that's how we get it back.
What's a grappling hook? Is it like a big...
Proper grappling hook.
Oh, there you
go.
And then you hook it up again.
Yep, then just pull it up.
Very Kiwi way of doing things.
It is. A lot of number six wire.
How often do we discover new species down there? Because I presume we know but a fraction, and we can't know what we don't know.
Yeah, you just have to look anywhere we haven't looked before and look carefully, and there are still loads of new species. So we just got back from the Bounty Trough expedition. It got fairly good news coverage, so you might have heard. Our initial tally was about 100 new species, and it's going to be well above that. I think my colleague, Kerry Walton, the mollusk curator, I think he's already topped that, along with Bruce Marshall. So we're really ticking off some species here. And that was a lovely partnership with NIWA as well.
I think we talked to them about it. What are holotherians?
Sea cucumbers.
Okay. Sponges, black corals, octopus, rat tail fish.
Ah, love those guys.
Do fishes have tails? Can they?
Yeah.
Of course they do. Well, they've got that thing they swim with.
Well,
but we think there's a tail. Why is it called a rat? Because
it's got a long, thin tail.
Yeah.
So that's something we see a lot in the deep sea. So when you think of shallower water fish, you think of that paddle sort of V-shaped tail.
Mm, mm.
And in the deep sea, they tend to have these long, tapering tails. And
right.
It's partly to save energy. So rather than pushing off against the water behind them, they kind of undulate and roll the water down their body. Yeah. So everything looks kind of eely. Everything tends to be grey or brown. It makes my job difficult because they all look the same.
Sea spiders?
Yes, Pycnogonids. Gonads. They look like a kid made them out of pipe cleaners. They look like an arts and crafts thing.
Are they pretty average looking? Is that what you're saying?
No, they don't look real. That's the problem. They're bright orange, the ones we were seeing. And that was an interesting thing. Usually we would see ones maybe about the size of a glass of water, sort of palm of your hand size. But we got huge ones on this one. I was struggling to take photos of them, maybe a couple of feet across. And that's more like the Antarctic ones. That's where they get really big.
We have to discuss, finally, from this Bounty Trough visit, the Vulcan octopus. Who came up with that name?
Oh, I've not heard it.
Oh, you haven't heard of it either.
Well, this is the problem with common names. Like, you get some strange nicknames.
It's a deep sea octopus of some sort. Yeah,
we did get some amazing cephalopods. There was a lovely it wasn't a glass squid. I'm not so good with the squid.
What sort of depth was the Bounty Trough then?
that was a nice little jaunt. So we go straight out from Otago, and we started about 600 metres.
Yeah.
And it looks like a meandering riverbed, but it goes right down to almost 5,000 where it meets the abyssal plain.
So what I'm wondering is, as you get deeper and deeper, do you get to, by and large, to simpler and simpler creatures?
The numbers sort of reduce. There's maybe less diversity down there. You know, you think of a coral reef with hundreds of thousands of species. As you get deeper, you get a little bit weirder. You get sort of specialists who are making their living in the deep sea. Another thing the deep sea is good at doing is almost preserving things like a bit of a nature reserve. So a lot of older types of animals you find preserved in the deep sea.
We're going to talk a little bit more about some of the curious creatures down there, because people just love that stuff. But there is also still a mystery about it, and it's been in literature and it's been in films, and is it still in many people's common perceptions? Almost a fear of the deep sea, and is that simply because there's few places now where we don't know much, and it's one of them?
Yeah, we wrote a whole paper sort of exploring that as part of our team, and yeah, we just found this weird pushback. So we would try and advocate for these animals and advocate for this research. And there seemed to be a reluctance, and we couldn't put our finger on it because it didn't seem very logical. And part of the Five Deeps expedition, my old boss, Alan Jameson, was sat with Glenn Singleman, who's a crazy sort of expedition doctor, but real daredevil. And then over noodles, he just says like, oh, well, it's because it represents the id. And we sort of choked on our noodles a little bit, and it's like, what do you mean? It's
like,
it's the subconscious. Mm-hmm. We don't like the dark and hidden things inside us. And he thought that people were sort of used to repressing those kind of feelings. I took a bit more of a literal take, where I think that the surface is about life and birth and sort of verdancy. And then the deep sea is the antithesis. It's about death and decay, and it feels unclean. And I think some people don't like it for that reason. But as air-breathing mammals clinging to the rocks,
pretty obvious,
it's such a different habitat that, you know, we can't get our head around it.
But also it's that separation from your breathing, your need to breathe. And anyone who's scuba dived and got even to like 20 metres, you suddenly, and also you can't just shoot up, of course,
yeah,
because you have to, you just have to come up slowly in order to avoid the bends. But even looking up 20 metres and being 20 metres away from the air source, that's a provision of fear.
Something
as well.
Primal in you is saying, no, you
I need
air.
To breathe.
You
do
need
not
air.
Get away from air. Let's talk about some of the crazier creatures then, because they're useful. We can talk about all these different species, but they are kind of useful for scientists' talking points, aren't they? I mean, the poor old blobfish has had so much publicity. I'm sure it's because he looks... Everyone's got an uncle who looks like that.
It's a caricature, it looks like.
It kind of is. So, and also, it's very human. It's got a very large nose, if that's what it is, and a very sad face with some very large lips and a couple of little eyes there and a bald head.
So it's the classic... It's the classic blobfish picture that everyone will have seen. It became, feels like one of the first memes, and I've got a stuffed toy of it. It's become like an icon.
Does it not normally look like that?
It does not. And do you know that famous picture? Do you know he's a Kiwi? That was taken on the Niue vessel. That was part of the Norfans expedition.
Of course it was.
That world famous blobfish was caught right here.
So that blobfish doesn't get around looking like that all the time. It just happened to settle in that expression for a photographer.
It has an unfortunate time. So blobfish have tried to reduce their body density to sort of harmonize with the water. They're trying to be neutrally buoyant. And they're usually supported by all that pressure. And so when you take it out and you slap it on a bench...
Oh, everything sags!
It does. So the analogy I give is, if you took me into space, fired me out of an airlock, dragged me across the surface of the moon in a net, then put me in five times my normal gravity and took a picture and called me ugly, I think that's on you.
I think he's got character.
I think we identify with
him. I'm presuming he's a he, by the way. May not have sex. It may be, you know.
We'll have to look up the record, because it is a specimen. I think it's in the Australian Museum now, but we'll be able to get the sex if you want.
What would this poor he or she, or they, look like if it were underwater?
They're kind of a nice mottled olive green colour. That nose is a complete artefact. That's just the way the body is sort of sagging.
It just sagged.
Yeah.
It could have gone left or right. It went centre.
Yeah, it did. And I think we're sort of anthropomorphising, aren't
we? Of course
we're seeing a really human face in it.
Of course we are. We want to relate.
But it became an icon. I think it was voted the world's ugliest animal in 2014.
Look, here's another one. This will be photography again. This beautiful barrel eye.
Yes.
Who kind of looks like the planet, only shaped like a seal.
Spookfish is another name that they go by, right. And we've actually known about those since sort of the big expeditions of the middle of the last century. But we didn't know about that clear dome. So just to describe it, this has two very big green tubular eyes that are looking up, and they're super, super sensitive to the low light. So they're good at seeing the silhouettes of things. But what we didn't know about it is, it's always difficult to describe because, of course, everything's eyes are inside its head. But no, this thing's eyes are entirely inside its head, and it's looking through its own transparent head like the dome of a fighter jet. And that part is really fragile. So when we first got it by trawls from the last century, that part was damaged. We didn't know that it had that weird clear cockpit.
Can we see that from the outside? Can we see through the cockpit?
Yeah, that's not a doctored image at
because
all.
Because you look like you're looking into its brain and its innards, and you are.
It's got a clear head, and its eyes are within its head looking out like a window.
Wow. I mean, there's no reason not to do any of these things. That's what evolution is, right? Yeah. Everything's got its purpose. It's just that we don't normally get to see it. What are one or two of the others that have really perhaps surprised or intrigued you about underwater species and their cleverness, their adaptations?
My little favourite is the Hadal snailfish. So, you know, you've got all the pointy, scary things, and then you get... If you go deep enough, actually, things get cute again. So this is wild. Like, the world's deepest fish is adorable. And I know I'm biased, and I've probably got Stockholm Syndrome because I spend so long looking at these fish. But no, they're cute. They're about a foot long. They're pink. They've got little sort of upturned mouths. They look like they're smiling.
What are they called?
A snailfish, or a Hadal snailfish. Probably one of our pictures that comes up.
Yeah.
And these have outlasted every other fish. They've gone deeper than every other fish. And so they've got the place to themselves down there. So they specialise in these deep trenches we were talking about.
Yeah, it looks like a cute little wombat without any hair.
Yeah, they've got a creepiness to it.
Oh, it's that. I'm just anthropomorphising again. That looks like an arm, but it's something else going on, isn't it? Yeah.
But they're very, very cute. And because they sort of break all the deep sea rules, so usually deep sea fish are really trying to conserve energy and they're quite sort of sluggish looking. But these ones, because they've gone deeper than all the other fish, they can eat all the invertebrates, so they get a place to themselves. And they're quite social. They're quite friendly little things.
What is it that we don't know about the deep sea? Is it just species? Is it physics? Is it chemistry? Is it geology? Geography? Is it the works?
Because it's so difficult to get down there and get data, we are piecing it together from little fragments. So we've got records that there's only one record of something, and we have to call it rare, but it's probably not rare. Our data is rare. So the geology is all new, the chemistry is all new because it behaves differently down there. The tricky thing for us at the moment, especially it works with species as well, is we are worried that things are changing before we know what they were before. So we found a new species of amphipod in the Mariana Trench, and they all had plastic in their guts. And so we don't know, that was a brand new species, we don't know what that species was like before it was polluted. And so that's the worry. You know, we're trying to measure things now, but actually, is this normal? And we don't know.
Mm. But it's also just that, as I said, the conditions, the physics and the chemistry of the deep sea, as well as its biology, right? How far advanced are we on that?
There's been a real renaissance, I'd say, in maybe the last 10 years. The technology has really leapt on. There's technologies in more people's hands than it's ever been before. And I've hoping that we're getting a sort of renewed interest from the public, because actually public interest really does steer science. You know, what would you like to know? What can we share with you?
The plastics, how would they have got, well, they're in everything, they're in breast milk, for goodness sake, but how, microplastics, how would they have gotten to these species? What would have been the path of transmission?
Because these deep trenches are kind of wedge-shaped, they funnel things into them, basically. Mm. So once plastic floats for a while, but once it gets broken down by UV, once it gets small enough, it sinks. And that's when it sinks into these places.
So that's not microplastic we're talking about, is it? It's plastic.
You see both. You see both. So it's microplastics in the guts, but on the subdives, Alan was seeing plastic bags and tin cans and all sorts.
Dr. Tom Lindley is our guest. He is curator of fishes at Te Papa. He also hosts the Deep Sea podcast, where he speaks with fellow scientists about their discoveries in the hopes of demystifying them. The discoveries, not the scientists. 26 and a half minutes past 10 it is on 9 to noon. You wanted to talk about curator of fishers. What was the illusion there?
Oh, well, that's double-barreled. For one thing, there's two of us. Andrew Stewart, I'm sure you've had on the show.
Yeah.
So he's the other curator of fishes. But, Here's a little fact for your pub quiz. If there's lots of one type of fish, those are fish. If there's multiple species of fish, those are fishes. So since I look at lots of different fishes, it's fishes.
I was putting the R in. I thought you might have been a crack kind of fly fisherman as well. But that's a little shallow for you in both ways. Let's talk about the podcast and the way scientists are outreaching now and trying to reach more and more people. The visuals are great, aren't they? But the podcasts carry their own kind of... You just listen more. When you watch, you get fixated on what the blobfish looks like, right? How are you finding this in other means of sort of contemporary science communication?
I think there's a bit of a renaissance, and I think we're worried that sometimes... Well, the reason the podcast started was we would do something really exciting, we'd write a press release, and then it would get mangled into the same sort of aliens, monsters, horrible things, we don't know anything. And we didn't have a response.
Wait for ChatGPT, Tom.
We couldn't say, like, actually, that's not true. And it's really interesting. So we wanted to give ourselves a voice, and we wanted to give other scientists a voice. Yeah. And then you're getting it from the horse's mouth. You know, there's a lot of stuff that keeps bouncing around because it's exciting, not because it's true.
Are you saying that people like me are terrible at our jobs?
No, you're pretty solid. You're pretty solid. It's the tertiary media I'm finding. It's the ones that sort of piggyback on other people's stories.
So that ability to speak, and this is what a good science communicator does, just to speak, and you can stick to the facts, and you can, you know, answer questions as well very often in these environments. They're an important part of outreach now, right?
Yeah.
Yeah. Can we talk about another matter? I alluded to this at the start. I watched one of your podcast series because I learned a lot from it, and you were talking about neurodiversity in science, but I also learned a lot about education and about institutions like the scientific institutions from that podcast. You had to work damn hard for your education and also to get where you've got. And could you tell us a little bit more about that?
Yeah, I am very, very dyslexic. It certainly feels that way, at least. I was lucky enough to have a really supportive family who sort of fought for me. But I'd say me, along with a cluster of neurodivergent people who sort of think a little bit differently, the standardized sort of schooling system is tough. You know, we don't learn in that way. We're not stupid, but we don't respond well to the way it's classically taught. And I'm not actually bashing that, because we are a minority and you have to cater for the majority. But I think it makes a huge difference if you can spot when someone learns a little bit differently and sort of encourage that. I think if it wasn't for me being absolutely obsessed with fish and like, no, I am going to do this and forcing through, I don't think I would have managed. And I think a lot of really talented people maybe fall by the wayside in those early days. And then you can get it sort of secondarily, where we kind of have associations. We were chatting about accents a little bit before we came on air. And if you spell badly, it is interpreted as you not being very smart.
Humans and our heuristics and our kind of, you know, simplistic shortcuts, which is what prejudice is, I think. And I it served us when there was a hairy mammoth there and I had to make a quick call whether I was going to shake hands with it or not. But unfortunately, we carry that through to the modern day, you know. And the accents was an interview just a couple of weeks ago. People will seriously make a judgment about intelligence, about trustworthiness, about whatever.
Even your political opinion, based on your accent.
Yeah.
You know, oh, you're from there, so you probably think this.
You probably think this as well. Do you mind me also mentioning the dyspraxia, which we've discussed previously on the show, but just perhaps a little bit less known? And just again, what... educators and what others need to know to make an environment, make it easier for people living with dyspraxia or any number of neurodivergent neurodiversities.
I think we just need to play to the huge variety of humanity. I think that's actually our strength, and as we become more focused on sort of streamlining the way we move through lives, we've lost some of that nuance, and we get the feeling that, oh, why are all these people turning up now? Well, actually, I think we've made society such a laser focus that we're just seeing them now. Hunter-gatherers you know, we now say somebody with ADHD is oh, we need to sort of treat them differently. We need to sort of make all these allowances. If you're hunter-gathering and you've got someone who is always vigilant, always looking around you, your ADHD friend has spotted the saber-toothed tiger while you were really fixated on the berries. And I think it's always been part of humanity, and I think that's our strength. And that's where I'm seeing it in science, that people who can get through the difficult sort of quagmire and actually get into science, they are invaluable, because you can fill a room with really smart people, but if they're all the same type of smart, they're having the same ideas. You need variety in your team, and that's when you get some incredible ideas.
Thank you so much, Tom. It's been a real pleasure having you here. Tom Linley, who is curator of fishes at Te Papa Tongarewa, the National Museum. He also co-hosts the Deep Sea podcast, which I highly recommend, and he's also been part of programs. His work's featured on shows including Blue Planet 2 and Shark Week.